My name is Julien Maneg. I work at Microsoft Security Engineering Center in Redmond. Today I'm going to present a joint paper with Sean Hillen, previously at Immunity, and Ralph Rolls, who just joined Exodus Intelligence. The paper is about automating. So Jeff Moss, in his keynote yesterday, talked about the importance of automation. Indeed, like pen testers or exploit writers, even copy protection analysts, reverse engineers, are very good at doing what they do, but not so good at scaling. And SMT solvers is one way of scaling this kind of technology, of a need for the security industry. So today, I'm going to go really briefly about SMT solvers for three applications. The first application is vulnerability checking. The second is exploit generation. And the third is copy protection. Overall, what a SMT workflow with an SMT solver is about is you take a program, you translate that program, you abstract the program into first-order logic formula usually. And then you reason about the formula. So I'm going to give a few examples today. Overall, the message I'm going to give you today is that SMT solvers are really good at solving problems. They're not very good at generating problems. So as long as you have an expert who's able to generate problems to give to the SMT solver, SMT solvers are very convenient tools to rely upon. SMT solvers are not meant to generate the problems, so you can't give a program and tell the SMT solver, find all the bugs or generate an exploit for that. No, it's not the way it works. It's more of an assistant to a human. All right, so divide into three parts. First of all, vulnerabilities. So when you check, when you have an SMT solver to find vulnerabilities, usually the vulnerability checker involve the following four steps. The first step is involve the security auditor. The security auditor knows the kind of vulnerabilities he's looking for. We at Microsoft, we call that variation analysis. So whenever we know of a certain vulnerability class and we want to find all instances of such vulnerability class, then we can create a contract. What is a contract of the program with respect to this class of properties? For example, you can say, oh, we don't want to use after freeze, we don't want buffer overflows, we don't want integer overflows. So how can we capture that using constraint on the programs? So first thing, you need a human being to actually write this contract. You've got a translator, a compiler, if you will. It's a very specific kind of compiler that takes the source code or the binary code of the program, translate it into a form, an intermediate form that's suitable for analysis. Usually compilers do that a lot, but for the purpose of verification or exploit generation or copy protection analysis, then the intermediate representation, the IRs, are kind of specific to those problems generally. The more specific you are, the more natural it's going to be to resolve those problems. And then once you have this program in intermediate form, the verification or exploit generation framework is going to generate a big formula that abstracts the program in this intermediate form into a logical formula. So we call, for the purpose of vulnerability checking, we call this formula the verification condition, or VC. I'm going to say VC quite a lot today. And then the VC is passed to the SMT solver, finally. The SMT solver is going to be able to say if the VC is always true, it's provable at every point in the program or at a specific point in the program. And then if this is the case, then we don't have any vulnerabilities. But if the VC is violated at certain points, at the precondition of a function, post-condition of a function, then we've got an analysis alert. And then the human being is getting in the loop again to review those warnings. So I'm going to give a small example of that. One of the tools we use to do static vulnerability checking at Microsoft is called Havok, the heap aware verify for C and C++ programs. So the way it works is the following. You give it a C and C++ source program, you give it a bunch of annotations or a bunch of directives to the analyzer. You also give it memory model, so what is an accurate but abstract enough description of the architecture you're analyzing. These memory models, those axioms of the memory model were described in a paper in a Principle of Programming Language conference in 2009. And then once you give it to that, you translate the C and C++ and the annotation into an intermediate form. We call that a Boogie program. And then the Boogie verification framework takes hand. It takes the Boogie program and it generates the VC. And finally, the VC is passed to the SMT solver. And the SMT solver, for example, Z3, it's a very efficient SMT solver developed at Microsoft Research. It can reason about decision, about types, lists, and arrays, uninterpreted function. It's very powerful. And it's able to actually model a program pretty naturally. Then the SMT solver runs on the VC. And if everything goes fine, then the VC is verified everywhere. There is no bug. If the VC says there could be a counterexample, then the trace of that counterexample is given, and a warning is emitted. One small example I'm going to give. I really like this example because it was said to be really hard to analyze automatically by static analysis. I gave a full-blown presentation of that thing a few months ago at SemaCon and Recon, and today I'm going to give you a condensed version, but essential version of it. It's a bug that was found 10 years ago by Mark Dowd, and it was exploited by LSDPL, pretty famous group of hackers. In 4 hours, they came up with a bug track post explaining all the steps to do the exploitation of the bug. It's a remote root vulnerability in SendMail, 5.79. Last year, it was presented by Thomas Julian, the chair of Woot, explaining that this is a very hard vulnerability kind to actually analyze. And mostly Halver found, took the example of past instance analyzers such as abstract interpreters to make his point. Today we're going to show that if we change our standpoint a little bit, leave the abstract interpreters on the side and focus on SMT solver based analyzers, we're going to see that we're able to reason about these kind of problems. So the code is the following. It looks like pretty complicated. It looks a very complicated loop, in fact. What happens is that you're going to have an overflow, stack-based buffer overflow over there on those two lines. And what you're going to need to do is actually to give a lot of opening parentheses. If you enable that line, then everything is safe, everything is secure. But in the original code, this line is commented. And that triggers a buffer overflow on the D pointer that, in fact, points over there on the local buff. So it looks complicated. It's a loop with the input being user-controlled. So what happened here, first of all, the first thing to notice to understand that this is checkable, this is amenable by static analysis, is to show that, to realize that each if block is mutually exclusive. So whenever you execute one iteration of the loop, in fact, you either execute this or this or this or this, but never two at the same time. It's pretty obvious because C, in fact, it's the recondition on C, the current character of the input. And if it's an opening hook, you execute that. Else, if it's not, a closing hook, you execute that. Opening parentheses, you execute that. Closing parentheses, you execute that. In that loop, you've got mostly two or three state variables, quotation, round quote, and upper limit. Upper limit is supposed to be a variable that points to a certain bound of the buffer. In fact, upper limit, buffer size is 25, I should say, over here. So upper limit, in fact, is a local buff plus 15 at the beginning of the loop. You expect this check to actually prevent the buffer overflow. But without this line, there is a problem. So in fact, the way to represent this piece of code in an abstract manner is to have a finite state automaton. We take the domain, the three variable domain, a quotation, round code value, and the value of upper limit. Here that should be global buff and not local buff. I'm sorry about that. So basically, first, you start in a state of having quotation and round code variable to false, and the upper limit being local birth plus 15. That is the starting point of the loop. Then you have a certain amount of transition you can do. For example, you can execute this piece of code, and you go to that state where a quotation becomes true and the upper limit is decremented. And then what you can do once you're there, for example, is to come back. The only thing you can do, in fact, if you look at that carefully, is to just come back at the original state where this comes back to false and upper limit becomes the original value again. Well, you back to your original state, you can take, for example, this transition. One code becomes true, and in the same version of the code, then you see that upper limit equal local birth plus 14. You're into that state, and then what you can do is to take this transition, for example, and then the two state variables become true, and then upper limit is plus 13 because you decrement it a second time. And then you can come back, and then you have an increment, and then this quotation becomes false again, and then you can come back like that, and with a closing parenthesis, and then the round code becomes false, and the upper limit comes back to the original value. What you could do as well is just to do it like that, just to take this one and this one, and then you come back to the original state which we have already treated. So the number of states in the loop is actually very small. That's the main reason why we can use SMT solvers to check these kind of vulnerabilities. The way we pass this invariant, this loop invariant, to the Havok tool is by giving the following assertion. We say either the loop must be in this state, or it must be in this state, or in this one, or in this one. In fact, it corresponds to each state with a disjunction over here, and we just forget about the transition. As long as at the beginning of an iteration you're in one of those four states, then everything is fine. This today has to be given by the user. This is not synthesized automatically by the SMT solver, which is why such solution is not completely automated. As soon as you have, for example, a developer or a security analyst who is able to come up with such invariants, then you can check the loops. For example, if you don't have any regression, no vulnerability were introduced inadvertently, et cetera. So this is we call that an inductive invariant because we can prove the base case. We can prove that at iteration, and if the invariant is true at iteration n, then it's going to remain true at iteration n plus 1. And if you prove those two conditions, the base case and the induction case, then you've got a proof that this holds at every iteration of the loop. So that's one way of using SMT solvers. It's the way to find or to guarantee the absence of vulnerability. Another interesting application of SMT solvers is about exploit generation. We've talked a lot about exploits today, and it's kind of a fantasy of hackers to actually be able to generate exploits automatically. This is not a trivial problem. People have been starting to publish in the last couple of years about exploit generations. We'll see that we're still far from the Grail, even though we've got a few improvements behind us and a lot more ahead. So loosely defined, automated exploit generation is given a program and a known vulnerability of that program. How can we craft an input to the program that's going to redirect the control for that program for untrusted execution? That's the definition of an exploit, getting untrusted execution. For example, I'll give an example in a second. Yeah. So mostly the techniques that have been relied upon for this kind of application are symbolic executions or concolic, which means concrete symbolic execution frameworks. Basically, symbolic execution are tools that allow you to execute the program in an abstract way, getting rid of all the irrelevant details. For example, which variables are tainted, or you can do a zero analysis to say, oh, which variables are zero, which pointers are null, which one are trusted, et cetera, et cetera. The SMT solver in this particular application is going to allow us to understand what are the logical conditions to actually reach specific points in the program. We call that condition the path condition. And the pass condition is constructed over a language of constraints. Of course, those constraints correspond to the constraint that needs to be taken by the jumps, the ifs and the else of the program to reach those particular locations. Just very quick example on assembly code this time. We start by AL register, and we call that the value, the abstract value, or the symbolic value, if you will, of the AL register, we call it A0. Every time we're going to assign a new value to a variable, for example, the register AL, we're going to create a new version of that particular location or memory location or register. It's very similar to static single assignment form, for those of you who know a little bit about compilers. And what we're going to be able to do here is that we're going to be able to say, oh, at location 6, then the condition that's true, whenever you reach that location, this formula is true. It has to be true. If it's not true, then you can't reach that location. That's called the path condition. So, for example, we say that A1, the output value of this add instruction, it's an addition of those, the two A0, and we know that A2, that's the output value after the first statement number one, it's actually A1 minus 15, which is 0x0f. And then we know that A2 is going to be 0 because we test for that value. If the test were not true, if AL were not 0, we wouldn't be able to jump here. We would continue the execution. So we know that whenever we reach that, this formula is true. And this formula is what exploit generation framework built upon to actually understand what is controlled, what are the constraints, et cetera, et cetera. The way that we keep track of those information over the memory of the program being under attack is by creating what we call a map. A map is just a function or an array, if you will. In fact, you given a memory cell, you can know what are the formulas that hold for this particular memory cell. For example, we can say that, oh, for register EAX, we have the following formula that's true, that EAX is different than 0, and also we know that EAX is tainted, it's user control. And this formula K does not have any information beyond the value. That's pretty much the state of the art in terms of exploit generation. We call that restricted models. We would like to have more information in the map K. Probably is going to be the topic of future work. We would like to know concurrency conditions. We would like to know asynchrony, like if we are in a signal handler, if we are processing an event, if we're going to generate an event, et cetera. We don't have that today. We current exploit generation framework rely on such a map that provides value information. Just to give a little example why this is not enough today. Especially for exploit mitigation. Maybe that was enough 10 or 15 years ago when no exploit mitigation were around or almost nothing. But today, with things like address space layout randomization, ASLR, it's become extremely more challenging to rely only on the map K. Why is that? Because K just gives us information about the values of the variable in the program. It doesn't give us information about how to manipulate the environment or what kind of action we need to perform to reach a certain environment to perform, for example, heap spraying. When we have the latest version of ASLR or even a little heap randomization in place, in one execution, we might be able to do an overflow of a chunk, erase the beginning of the next chunk. But in another execution, we might have a function pointer just over here that's a very nice target for override. If we override that function pointer with a known address, which is, again, a challenge given current mitigations, we might be able to have untrusted control execution. It's not sure if this is always the case because of those mitigations, and the map K doesn't provide any information about that. It doesn't provide any information about how to manipulate the heap to reach that state. It doesn't provide any way of guessing information such as the location of code to do return-oriented programming, et cetera. So the current state of the art in exploit mitigation is clearly not enough with current mitigations. However, we can use basic, what we call exploit templates. The exploit templates are very basic strategies, hard-coded strategies that are purely based on the map K, the content of the map K. For example, we can say, if that formula holds, then try to set this variable to this other value. For example, if a certain part of the stack is tainted, you might want to create a new formula where this particular memory cell has a certain value because you tainted it. So you just toggle in the value. You might want to say, I'm able to erase a return address on the stack. Therefore, I'm going to try to just extend the formula with and this particular memory cell is of a certain value so that you erase the return value with a known location in the program, for example, to do return into libc, return written program, etc. Again, the K map doesn't have any information about location in the program when subject to ASLR or even other environment information that we might want to rely upon for our exploits, for reliable exploits. We don't have any knowledge of bug chaining. So for example, modern exploits use a bug in a browser, and then to get complete access to the machine, they want to chain with a kernel bug. The current layout of the K map doesn't allow us to do this distinction. Not saying that it's not possible, but current state of the art doesn't have that. So maybe we're going to have bi-maps or multi-maps in the future. We're going to have maps that act on multiple variables at the same time, etc. This is not here today. This is the topic of current and future research. Also, we don't model information disclosures. Information disclosures are a very common technique nowadays to guess info about the address space of a program under attack. Nothing of that is currently modeled by the K-map. So we kind of wanted to deconstruct the myth of a fully automated exploit generation. Surely SMT solvers can be useful for a human to assist to assist exploit development, but this is clearly not a way to generate exploits entirely automatically. Maybe in the future, we're going to see domain-specific languages where instead of having static template strategies, we're going to have a little more dynamic template strategies by some programmatic way of selecting the templates or selecting the strategies. And of course, the question we want to ask ourselves is how do we encode such dynamic strategies in SMT solvers? That's not easy. That's not easy to understand. How we generate the constraint, how we do constraint generation for feeding the SMT solver, that's not obvious to us today. The third part, last part, shorter part, last but not least, is about analyzing copy protection. We've got two applications of SMT solvers for analysis of copy protections. The first one is equivalence checking. So for equivalence checking, for example, we've got a virtual machine based obfuscator. We want to understand if the virtual machine is actually obfuscating properly, which means you don't lose any semantics or you don't change the semantic of the program by obfuscation. If you do that, then it means that the virtual machine probably has a subtle implementation errors that could be exploited for bypassing copy protections. So one way, for example, to analyze VM-based copy protections is to generate the set of constraints of the unobfuscated code, generate the set of constraints for the obfuscated code, and see if those two sets of constraints are equivalent. If those are equivalent, it means that the VM obfuscator actually model the program appropriately. It doesn't lose any semantics. It doesn't introduce any spurious semantics. The other way of using SMT solvers for copy protection analysis is for crypt analysis. For example, key generation or key generations. So let me give a small example of that. Here is a typical routine for key validation. You'd have in the input, you'd have an activation code that's given by the user, and depending on a few arithmetic operations, and then you're going to say whether this key is valid or is invalid. If copy protection analyst is able to come up with the following, or even if he can write a translation from the assembly code into an SMT formula, then we just have to request a model for that formula. A model is a valuation of the variables appearing in the formula that satisfy the formula. So whenever we do this translation and then we request a model, it's a very standard operation of SMT solver, the SMT solver is going to give us the value of the input that satisfies the formula. This is very powerful. The input in that case is the activation code. So basically, by transforming this program into a formula, we say, okay, now, please, SMT solver, give me the value for which this formula is true. And then that is going to give us the activation code, basically what is a valid key for this key validation routine. That's something that Rolf Rolles, one of our authors here, have been using in the past few years to do copy protection analysis. Conclusion. We've used SMT solvers for a variety of applications that are very concrete in the realm of security. For the static analysis checking part, it's been fairly mature. People have been using this kind of technology for this application for a while. And with the advances of the architectural advances, the performance of nowadays processors, we can analyze millions of lines of code using this technology. However, we've got a way ahead to actually improve the technology, especially when it comes to feeding this SMT solver. And this step is called the constraint generation or the inference step. We've got lots of challenges. One of the challenges, how to model exploit mitigation bypass techniques for exploits. I'll be happy to take questions now.
The brief question is, all the formulas you showed were really propositional, whereas a lot of recent advances in SMT solving has to do with quantifiers. Do you have any interesting examples where you use quantifiers?
Yes. For example, we use universal quantifiers to say for all cells of an array, something holds. So for all I between 0 and M, M between being the bound of the array, M of I.
Fine. And I was only allowed one question, but have you considered weakest precondition analysis to propagate these formulas through programs?
Yes, we do have.
Inference?
We do have not just intra-procedural analysis, but also inter-procedural analysis. I would redirect you to the Houdini algorithm. Last year we published a paper called "Explain Houdini: Making Houdini Inference Transparent," and this has explanation of how we propagate constraint across functions. But if you have any more questions, I would surely take them offline, but I'll be glad to answer them.
Great, thanks.
Thank you. Thank you very much.